This Sunday, new battle lines in Ukraine.
Another stage of this operation is beginning.
Ukrainian fighters holding out in Mariupol.
We're still fighting. We destroyed one tank today, two armored fighting vehicles, and one armored personnel carrier.
As Russian forces take control of dozens of small towns, President Biden announces another $800 million in U.S. military aid.
He will never succeed in dominating and occupying all of Ukraine.
And new evidence of Russian war crimes emerges.
A cemetery of cars.
It's hard to imagine what happened with these people.
I'll talk to a top advisor to Ukraine's President Zelensky, to Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer, and to Republican Senator Roy Blunt, who recently returned from the region. Plus, newly released tapes.
I've had it with this guy.
Show Congressman Kevin McCarthy did want President Trump to resign after January 6th.
What he did is unacceptable. Nobody can defend that.
Will Mr. Trump still support McCarthy's bid to become Speaker? And
we really need to finish delivering on some big deal promises we made during the 2020 election.
I'll talk to Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren about what she says Democrats need to do to avoid disaster in November. Joining me for insight and analysis are NBC News White House correspondent Carol Lee, former White House political director for President George W. Bush, Sarah Fagan, New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker, and Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large of the 19th. Welcome to Sunday. It's Meet the Press.
From NBC News in Washington, the longest-running show in television history, this is Meet the Press with Chuck Todd.
Good Sunday morning. I'm Kristen Welker, filling in for Chuck Todd. While Russia's grand military ambitions may have failed, Vladimir Putin's ability to cause massive destruction and suffering remains undiminished and apparently unsatisfied. Russia launched missile strikes yesterday in a residential area of the port city of Odessa, which until now had been largely spared. Satellite imagery has captured evidence of what appears to be a massive gravesite outside of Mariupol, the latest sign of what could be Russian war crimes. Mariupol remains the scene of a desperate stand by Ukrainian fighters holding out against a siege Putin says not even a fly should be allowed to escape from. Russia hopes to capture the eastern Donbass region, and a Russian commander now saying all of southern Ukraine into neighboring Moldova. President Zelensky says U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin are expected to arrive in Kyiv today for talks on U.S. military assistance. We're going to begin our reporting this morning with a top advisor to President Zelensky, Igor Zhovka, who is in Kyiv this morning. Welcome to Meet the Press. Let's get right to it because we do have a lot to cover. As I just said, President Zelensky has said that he's expecting a visit by the secretaries of state and defense. What do they need to accomplish while they are on the ground so that their visit is more than just a photo op?
Well, first and foremost is the delivery of weapons. We are thankful for the U.S. administration for having the deliverers, especially the last two announcements the U.S. president made, not only important the amount, but also very important the items which were declared. This is exactly those items, those pieces of weapon we need on field. We really need armored vehicles. We really need artillery systems and MLRS. We need tanks in order to defend ourselves on the ground, in order to unblock such cities as Mariupol, in order to withstand the potential offensive of Russian armed forces in the Donbas. That's what we need immediately. That's what we need now. And that's what we need in bigger quantities. So the main subject of the discussion with two distinguished guests will be delivery of weapons.
Just to be very clear, do you need more of the weapons that you're getting, or do you need different weapons?
No, the weapons that we get now from the U.S. is almost these kind of weapons which we need. We definitely need some more weapons in terms of defending the sky over Ukraine, because NATO countries refuse to close the skies over Ukraine. So we also need anti-missile systems and anti-aircraft systems, because daily and nightly, Ukrainian cities are bombarded by the cruise missiles. You mentioned Odessa yesterday, just eight victims and more than 18 wounded. One family, a grandmother, a mother, and a child, a girl, 3 months. So yesterday, the Russian missile hit the multi-story building. So we badly also need the equipment to protect our sky.
Let's talk about what else is happening on the ground there. We know that Russia has said that it now controls Mariupol, a key port city. Ukrainian officials have pushed back about against that. They say that's not the case. And in fact, there are still Ukrainian forces that are holed up in a steel plant there that was bombarded overnight. Can you give us the reality check, though? Does Russia now have enough control of Mariupol that it controls it?
No. That's false. Russia does not control the whole city of Mariupol, though it controls some part of the city of Mariupol. Ukrainian armed forces are still in town. They are concentrated now mainly on the Azov-style steel plant, and they are concentrated there together with the civilians, and many of Ukrainian soldiers are wounded. My president suggested several times to have a humanitarian corridors in order to evacuate the civilians which are left on the Azov-style steel plant and the wounded soldiers. He proposed to exchange them for the Russian wounded soldiers which are in possession of Ukraine. No reaction. Today, we again turn to Russian authorities to open the humanitarian corridors for civilians, including for civilians who are living in the city of Mariupol, because more than 100,000 civilians are still left in the city, and the city is almost wiped down. I mean, and people are living without elementary conditions, without food, without water supply, without electricity. So that's what we both badly need. That's where we need the attention of international community.
Mr. Zhivko, let me ask you about what we are hearing from a top Russian commander who warned on Friday that Russia's goal is to capture the east and the south and to create a land corridor that stretches all the way into Moldova. Is that what you're bracing for?
The first aim was to capture, if not all Ukraine, but the major parts of Ukraine, including the capital city of Kyiv, city of Kharkiv, city of Odessa.
But do you think they're moving into Moldova, Mr. Zhivko? Are they moving into Moldova?
Well, I mean, they can move anywhere they want, but they will not. We will not let them do this because, I mean, capturing the whole Donbas is their dream starting from 2014. I have to remind you that the war started not in 2022. The actual war of Russia started in 2014 by capturing the Crimea and part of Donbas. So yes, now they want to capture the whole Donbas. Yes, they want to have the connection between Donbas and the Crimea. As far as the Moldova is concerned, yes, we heard those announcements of Russian officials. Who knows? You never know with Russia. But yes, that could be a high possibility.
It was reported on Friday that the UN Secretary General will meet with President Putin this coming week to try to negotiate a peace deal. Does the UN Secretary General, is he authorized to speak on behalf of the Ukrainian government?
Not really. And this is not a good idea to travel to Moscow. We do not understand his intention to travel to Moscow and to talk to President Putin.
So are there any hopes for these peace talks? Are there any hopes for these peace talks? What's the purpose then?
Well, I cannot tell you. I mean, any peace talks are good if they end with the result. I really doubt if those peace talks organized by Secretary General of the UN would end up with any result. UN should do more, not only in terms of political things. UNSC has to be reformed, but in terms of humanitarian things. UN is lagging behind in Ukraine in terms of humanitarian support to my country. So it would be good if UN Secretary General would concentrate on these things as well.
Okay. Mr. Zhivko, top advisor to President Zelensky, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Meet the Press.
Many thanks.
And joining me now is Deputy National Security Advisor John Finer. John, good to see you. Welcome to Meet the Press.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's start with President Zelensky saying that he is expecting a visit by the Secretaries of State and Defense. And he was very clear. He says, quote, they should not come here with empty hands, not just presents and cakes, but with specific weapons. What will they be offering specifically on this trip?
Well, Kristen, I'd say a few things. One is that we are in very close contact, many of us, with our Ukrainian counterparts, including those two secretaries, including the president and President Zelensky at all times. We've also been quite clear that if we were going to take some sort of high-level visit to Ukraine, we would not be announcing that in advance. So I suspect that'll be a bit of an unsatisfying answer, but nothing to say further about that. In terms of empty hands, I would point to the last 2 weeks and really the last 10 days when the United States has announced $1.6 billion in additional security assistance that is having a significant effect on the ground in terms of enabling Ukraine to continue to hold off and push back Russian forces.
John, we've been talking about the possibility of a high-level trip for quite some time. If such a trip were to occur at some point, would there need to be deliverables in order for it to be effective?
We have been announcing deliverables, which is a fancy word for things that we are providing to the Ukrainians to enable their fight. Just about every day, and if not every day, every week. And we will have more to say about that in the week ahead.
You just heard Mr. Zhivko say that Russia does not have complete control of Mariupol. Is that the U.S. assessment as well?
I would defer to the Ukrainians, who have a much closer kind of ground level view of what's happening in Mariupol. Our understanding is that Russian forces and Ukrainian forces are continuing to fight in that city. And we are continuing to try to get the Ukrainians as much assistance as possible to enable them in that fight.
I want to ask you about this Russian official saying that the goal now is to try to build a land bridge into Moldova. Is it your assessment that that's a real threat? How concerned is the Biden administration about that possibility?
Well, I think it's important to take a step back, as my Ukrainian counterpart did, and point to the shifting Russian war aims over time. We know very well that Russia's initial intention was to take over, if not all of Ukraine, the vast majority of it, to topple the government. Because of the resistance that they've met on the ground, again, enabled by U.S. assistance and the very brave fighting by the Ukrainian forces, they have had to adjust. So they are now focused on the south and the east. That's quite clear.
And are they going into Moldova as well, do you believe?
I think where they go from here remains to be seen, but they are a long way from cities like Odessa and certainly from Moldova. To your earlier question, they have a lot of fighting still to do, and we think the Ukrainians are going to be very effective in fending them off.
If they did move into Moldova or made moves in that direction, would that change the United States strategy at this point toward Ukraine?
I think we've shown an ability to be nimble, to adjust our assistance and our approach as the Russian war aims have evolved, and we will continue to do that over time, depending on how things evolve on the battlefield.
Is the U.S. policy objective right now for Ukraine to defeat Russia? Can you say that definitively?
So I can say our objective is to continue to enable the types of activity that allowed the Ukrainians to win a victory in the battle for Kyiv. Russia intended to take over the capital of Ukraine, to topple the Ukrainian government. The Ukrainians won that battle. We think that exact approach is going to be the way we follow through in the battles ahead, now focused on the south and the east.
Well, so then by that logic, is the broader policy goal to see Ukraine defeat Russia writ large?
In our view, Russia has already lost many of its initial war aims. They have intended to divide the West. They have resulted in a West and a NATO alliance that is much more united than it's ever been. They thought that they would unsettle and undermine and maybe even overthrow the Ukrainian government. President Zelensky is firmly entrenched in power, and Ukrainian democracy continues. Russia is more isolated in the world. Its economy is weaker. They are failing at virtually every one of their initial objectives, and our objective is going to be to continue that trend.
And you just heard Mr. Zhivko express real skepticism about the UN Secretary General holding talks with Putin. How is the administration viewing those talks? Are you skeptical, or do you think that there could be some progress that comes out of those talks?
Well, I think a very important principle for any negotiations and any discussions diplomatically on the conflict of Ukraine is that Ukrainians should be the touchstone. There should be nothing that goes on about the conflict in Ukraine without close consultation and involvement of the Ukrainian government.
You just heard Mr. Zhivko say that the UN Secretary General is not authorized to speak on behalf of Ukraine. So is there any point to these talks?
Again, I defer to the Ukrainians on what their conversations have been with the United Nations. We're in very close consultation with the Ukrainians and our other partners and allies, and we'll be proceeding along those lines.
Let me ask you about these new satellite images, which appear to show evidence of one, potentially two mass graves outside of Mariupol. Has the U.S. assessed that we are, in fact, looking at mass graves, or these evidence of more war crimes here, John?
So we've been quite clear that we have seen significant evidence of atrocities, of war crimes. You've heard very strong language come out of our administration about a number of the tactics the Russians are using, deliberately targeting civilians in places like Mariupol and elsewhere. That would be wholly consistent with how Russia has been prosecuting this war from the beginning.
Have you confirmed that those are new, that's new evidence of new mass graves?
Again, I've got nothing to announce on that specific allegation, okay, but it is wholly consistent with everything that we've seen Russia doing, and it should stop.
And as you well know, President Zelensky has asked the Biden administration to declare Russia a state sponsor of terrorism. What is the latest update? Is the administration prepared to do that at this point?
So I think we've been clear that we're looking at that, as we're looking at a whole range of other additional steps that we could take to hold Russia accountable for the crimes that it's perpetrating on the ground in Ukraine. But I would also say that we are not waiting for those determinations to be made in order to start imposing costs on Russia. Costs that at this point outside analysts have said it is going to lead to a 15% or more reduction in Russia's GDP over the course of the year, and that Russia's own officials are saying the impacts are going to continue to intensify in the weeks and months ahead.
All right. John Finer, good to see you. Thank you so much for joining me at the press. Really appreciate
it. Thanks very much.
And as we mentioned, the U.S. is providing another $800 million in military aid to Ukraine. We just talked about that with John Viner. President Biden announced the aid package on Thursday.
The Battle of Kyiv was a historic victory for the Ukrainians. It was a victory for freedom, won by the Ukrainian people with unprecedented assistance by the United States and our allies and our partners. Now we have to accelerate that assistance package to help prepare Ukraine for Russia's offensive that's going to be more limited in terms of geography, but not in terms of brutality.
And joining me now is Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, who recently returned from the region. Senator Blunt, welcome back to Meet the Press. Good to see you.
Well, Kristen, great to be with you. You know, the three big surprises, I think, of what's happened in the last 2 months is the incredible resistance of the Ukrainians, the almost rebirth of NATO, and the lack of performance of the Russian military. I'm sure Putin's surprised by that, and frankly, I think we are too. I've been on intel for about 10 years, and we didn't have any suggestion that any of those three things would happen in the level that they have.
Well, and you did just return from the region, and now, of course, President Zelensky has said he's anticipating a visit from the Secretaries of State and Defense. The Biden administration not confirming that visit, but assuming that it does, in fact, happen, what needs to happen in order for that visit to be effective, to bear fruit?
Well, I think you always want to have some deliverable when you have a visit like that. But
do you
in this
expect
case,
they will? Do you expect they will?
Well, I think they'll probably be able to announce some things about equipment, about the speeding up our efforts there. In this case, it's just a deliverable to go. And, you know, I think it's a good thing if they go and when they go. I think we ought to be thinking about reopening our embassy there. And if the Ukrainian people can stay, I think our diplomats are willing to be there. I met with a number of them. Just last week, I think they're a little bit frustrated that they're barely outside the country, but they're outside the country and trying to manage all of the efforts of American volunteers. There are several hundred American volunteer groups trying to help people get food and shelter and clothing. And those Americans are there, and I think our the people that represent our country officially can safely be there now as well.
Senator, let me ask you about something you said earlier this week. The White House downplayed Russia test firing an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile. But you said this week of Vladimir Putin, quote, he doesn't want to start a nuclear war. What gives you that confidence?
Well, I think he's seen what happens in the war he started that he thought he would win in a week. He's not prepared for that. They don't have an economy that will support that. They've got more than they can deal with right now.
Do you evidence to believe that, or is that your gut?
This is just my instinct. He also said this week when Finland talked about and Sweden talked about joining NATO, well, if that happens, Scandinavia will no longer be a nuclear-free area. It's just ridiculous. You know, they've got, at Kaliningrad, they've got nuclear capacity there. He's a bully. He's a bully, and he keeps coming up with some new threat. Frankly, I think, Kristen, it's time Putin began to worry about what we would do rather than us worrying as much about what he would do. And we need to stop saying what we won't do. Even if we know we won't do it, there's no reason to ever tell your adversary in a situation like that where your red lines are.
Senator, let me ask you about the big story this week impacting your party. This is this new audio tape that we heard from the top Republican in the House, Leader Kevin McCarthy. It began with these revelations in the new book, This Will Not Pass. The authors released audio in which we hear McCarthy days after January 6th saying this about then President Trump. Take a listen. I'll get your reaction on the other side.
Okay. No, it'll pass the House. I think there's a chance it'll pass the Senate even when he's gone. And the only discussion I would have with him is that I think this will pass, and it would be my recommendation we should be done.
For context, I think it's important to point out that before the audio was released, McCarthy said that the words were totally false. He's now said that the tape was taken out of context. We understand that he's spoken to former President Trump. They've mended fences. But you just heard the audio, Senator Blunt. Given the disconnect, how can Americans believe what the top Republican in the House says?
Well, a lot of people were saying a lot of things in that 2 weeks. I haven't talked to the minority leader in the House about this, but he's been close to Trump. Frankly, when I first heard this, I thought anybody who'd been as close to President Trump as Kevin McCarthy was would know that the last thing that Donald Trump was going to do was either resign or quit. It was a pathway. We're 10 days to the end of his term. There was no way that was going to happen, and I was frankly sort of surprised that Kevin would even suggest it might be a realistic suggestion to make to President Trump.
Is it a credibility problem, though, that he came out and denied it, and now there's tape that the world has heard that disproves his denial?
Well, you'll have to ask him that. My guess is you don't remember every conversation you're in exactly the way it occurred, and maybe you remember it the way you want it to occur, but, I'm the only one of two people in the history of the country have been elected leaders in both the House and Senate. I've never been in a leadership meeting where you felt like you couldn't think out loud, and apparently they have a leadership where you can't think out loud.
Could it doom his chances, though, to become the next Speaker of the House should Republicans win back the House?
I think it depends on the margin.
So it could?
Anything could impact that. You know, when you want to be Speaker, you don't just get the majority of your members. You have to get almost all of your members, and that's challenging. But I will tell you this. I think a lot of things will happen between now and November. I think one thing that's likely to happen is Republicans will be in the majority. And if that happens, nobody will have worked harder to make that happen than Congressman McCarthy has.
Let me ask you about the Senate and Leader McConnell. Apparently, according to the same book, this will not pass, said to two longtime advisors at the time, the days after January 6th, quote, the Democrats are going to take care of the SOB for us. He said Donald Trump's behavior, quote, if this isn't impeachable, I don't know what is. You are close to Leader McConnell. Is that consistent with what he was saying to you at
the
time?
You know, I never heard him say anything like that. He's a fairly closely held guy. At the end of the day, he didn't vote for impeachment. And, you know, the Democrats were trying to impeach somebody who was already out of office. I think my view has been if President Trump did anything that was illegal, there's a process for that. But you don't remove people from office who are already out of office.
Well, but was it your gut reaction, Senator? And again, you were involved in the broader conversations within your chamber, mm-hmm. that his actions were potentially worthy of conviction. Apparently, McConnell said he was considering that. Did you consider that for a moment?
No.
You now, never considered convicting former President Trump?
Well, one, it's not my job. And two, what I've said about that, whether it was President Trump or the people who inappropriately attacked the Capitol, anybody who committed a crime there, either planned a crime or committed a crime, there is a process for that. And I'm not suggesting that President Trump did either of those things, but there's a process for that. And it's not a political process. It's a judicial and legal process. I've been fully supportive of the Justice Department effort to prosecute people who are in the Capitol, and I've also added to that people who somehow were illegally planning activities on that day.
Did you ever hear Leader McConnell say he believed there may be enough votes for conviction?
No.
Okay. Let me ask you, because former President Trump was out on the campaign trail last night. Mm-hmm. He's endorsed more than 140 candidates. Just last night, he repeated some of those mistruths about the election. Do you think if he is the Republican nominee, would you vote for him?
Well, we're a long time to that. And of course, I'll be out of politics by then. I'm not sure how active I'm going to be in politics in the future. But I've always voted for the Republican nominee in the past. And we'll see what happens.
You've always voted for the Republican nominee in the past. Will you do so again, no matter who the nominee is?
Well, there's going to be another nominee, and that will be the Democrat nominee. And that's the choice you have to make. So I would expect I'd be supporting the Republican nominee.
Will you commit to supporting the Republican nominee, even if it's Donald Trump?
Well, it's a long time between now and then. Overnight's a long time in politics. And so I can't imagine that I won't. You know, Donald Trump got elected because he satisfied people's need to send a message about their frustration with government. If he's the nominee again, that'll be because people are still frustrated with government and there aren't other Republicans who meet that need. We'll just have to see what happens between now and then.
Senator Roy Blunt, so good to see you. Thank you for being here and for your insights this morning. Appreciate it. When we come back, the outlook for Democrats in November's midterm election is bleak right now. Senator Elizabeth Warren says she has a plan to fix that. I'll talk to the Massachusetts Democrat. That's next.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us.
From compelling mysteries to in-depth investigations, our Dateline episodes are available as podcasts.
Follow Dateline NBC now to get new episodes every Tuesday. To listen ad-free, subscribe to Dateline Premium on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or datelinepremium.com.
Great storytelling with a twist from the true crime original.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Senator Elizabeth Warren ran her 2020 presidential campaign promoting the idea of big structural change, and she hasn't given up on that idea. In the New York Times this past week, the Massachusetts Democrat wrote, quote, "Democrats cannot bow to the wisdom of out-of-touch consultants who recommended we simply tout our accomplishments. Instead, Democrats need to deliver more of the president's agenda, or else we will not be in the majority much longer." Among Warren's progressive goals, higher taxes for big corporations, an end to corporate price gouging, some student debt cancellation, and lowering prescription drug prices. And Elizabeth Warren joins me now. Senator, welcome back to Meet the Press. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
You write in your op-ed, Senator Warren, Republican senators and broken institutions. You blame them for blocking the progress Democrats had promised. But Democrats control the House, the Senate, and the White House. So why aren't Democrats responsible for breaking their own promises to voters, Senator?
Look, my point is not to look in the rearview mirror. My point is to say we've got nearly 200 days left between now and the election. And there are families who are trying to make the decision at the checkout line which groceries to send back because they can't afford them. There are millions of people across this country who are saying they are not ready for student loan payments to be turned back on. They simply can't afford them. There are millions of people across this country who say that prices at the pump, prices at to try to buy a pound of hamburger have all gone up and they need help. Democrats ran and always run on trying to make government work for working people. We've got nearly 200 days left. That's what we need to put our energy on.
Senator, I'm going to ask you.
If we don't, then we haven't been there. So that's what we need to do.
Senator, I'm going to delve into inflation, what you just mentioned, in a moment. But sure. I want to just get down to brass tacks, what a deal might actually look like. Senator Manchin, of course, whose support you would need for any deal, has said he's open to supporting legislation that addresses just three things: climate change, prescription drug costs, and lowering the deficit. Could you support a narrower version of a package that leaves out some of your priorities like universal pre-K and expanded child tax credits?
Well, look, some of the things we want to do are attack inflation head on. And one of the ways that we attack inflation head on is we bring down costs for family. So, for example, putting money into child care so that millions of women can go back to work expands our capacity, expands the number of people in the workforce, and that actually helps drive down inflation.
Senator, I understand those are your priorities. Those are your priorities. And yet negotiations have been stalled since December. Senator Manchin, to some extent, Senator Sinema have said they're not going to support one of the things that you just mentioned because they are concerned it would add to the deficit, it would make inflation worse. Would you commit to a narrower package, that package that I just laid out? Can you just tell me, would you be able to vote for a bill that only included those three things, climate change, prescription drug costs, and lowering the deficit?
So the point I'm trying to make is that we need to do more. Yes, we need to do climate change. Yes, we need to do prescription drugs. And we need to make sure that we're paying for it by making sure that giant corporations that make billions of dollars in profits and pay nothing in taxes are actually paying a minimum tax. And yes, Amazon, I'm looking at you in that one, and other corporations. Look, We need to also authorize the FTC so they can go after companies that are price gouging. And we need to remember that it's not only what Congress can do, it's also what the administration can do. Millions of people need their student loan debt canceled. Mr. President, today would be a great day to cancel $50,000 in student loan debt for tens of millions of people across this country. My point is that we have nearly 200 days. And not just one negotiation going on, we should have multiple negotiations going on. There is a lot we can deliver for American families, and we need to make that happen.
Let me ask you about student loan cancellation, which you have been talking about for quite some time. You want the president to do it unilaterally. Two Obama-era economists, Senator Warren, Jason Furman and Larry Summers, have warned against the president's extension of the student loan moratoriums during this time of inflation, saying, quote, it's regressive and adding fuel to the fire of inflation. You are calling for more, though. Why does this spending make sense at this time when Americans are desperate for prices to come down?
Actually, what I'm calling for is to cancel a big chunk of student loan debt.
But they say it'll add to inflation. They say that'll add to inflation, Senator.
No, actually, not paying student loan debts has already been baked in. But what matters is how we're going to be out there helping millions of American people. You know, keep in mind, 40% of the folks who have student loan debt do not have a college diploma. These are people who tried, but life happened. You know, pregnancies and working three jobs and mom got sick and they had to move to another city. All those things. But now they earn what a high school grad earns and they are trying to manage college level debt. In addition to that, we know that there's huge racial inequality here. African Americans borrow more money to go to school, borrow more money while they're in school, have a harder time paying it off when they get out. It is the job of Democrats. It is the job of the party in power to help make people's lives better.
Senator,
we can do that. And the president can do that one all by himself.
Senator Warren, we learned this week in a leaked memo that Bernie Sanders is not ruling out a run in 2024. If President Biden decides he's not running, we want to be very clear. President Biden has said he's absolutely running. Here you are out with this op-ed. Are you ruling out a run in 2024 should President Biden decide he's not going to make another go?
I'm not running for president in 2024. I'm running for Senate. President Biden is running for re-election
in 2024,
and
Senator?
I'm supporting him.
Would you rule it out?
You can ask it any way you want, but I'm going to say the same thing. President Biden is running in 2024, and I'm supporting him.
Okay.
Cheerfully.
You heard my conversation with Senator Blunt about House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. It was notable in your op-ed, you yourself had sharp words about the Democratic Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, for her previous opposition to legislation that would ban members of Congress from owning and trading stocks. Now, of course, she says she now supports that legislation. But it does raise the question, do you have confidence in House Speaker Nancy Pelosi?
Yes. But let's be clear. One of the things that we should be doing as Democrats is restoring some confidence in Congress. And the way we can do that is to ban all stock, individual stock ownership, stock trading, buying, selling of any kind. And that's true for every member of Congress and true for their spouses. It's a step we can take right now to help restore some confidence that when people in Congress act, they're not acting to try to line their own pockets. They're acting on behalf of the American people. That would be a good thing for us to deliver.
All right. Let me ask you about something that everyone really has been talking about all week. That is masks. As you know, this Florida court ruled that the mask mandate was unlawful. There was a lot of confusion that followed that. Now, of course, the Biden administration is appealing that decision because the CDC has said that it's necessary from a health perspective. Are you satisfied that the Biden administration provided enough clarity on this issue when people really need it?
You know, I want to be clear about what's happening in the court case. And that is, I believe it's important that it is the CDC and our health professionals who are well-trained, who have all the data, who spend their lives in this area, are making the decision about what we need to do to protect public health, and not a single judge off in Florida. And I think that's what the appeal is about. I don't think it's about getting masks back on people's faces right this minute. It's about making sure that over the long haul, when we don't know what comes next in COVID, or heck, we don't even know what comes after COVID, we want to make sure that healthcare decisions and public health decisions are being made by public health officials, not a single judge sitting off by herself somewhere in Florida.
Senator Elizabeth Warren, we covered a lot of ground today. Thank you so much for joining me at the press. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And when we come back, the Kevin McCarthy tapes heard round the world, or at least round the world of Washington and Mar-a-Lago. The panel is next. Welcome back. The panel is here. NBC News White House correspondent Carol Lee, Aaron Haynes, editor-at-large of the 19th, former White House political director for President George W. Bush, Sarah Fagan, New York Times chief White House correspondent Peter Baker. Thanks to all of you for being here. Great to see you. I want to start off talking about Leader McCarthy. We've now all heard the audio where he talked about the possibility of calling former President Trump and asking him to resign. He's out and basically saying this tape was taken out of context. Here's what he had to say.
No, I've never asked the president to resign and never thought he should resign. What I was asked on a phone call was about the process of 25th Amendment, whether someone's impeached. We walked through ifs, ands, or buts. It was never in the process to ask President Trump to resign.
Carol, as you know, Leader McCarthy wants to become Speaker of the House. If Republicans win back the House, does this doom his prospects?
Look, it's too soon to know exactly what this does to his ambitions to be Speaker of the House. Republicans obviously first have to win the House in November. But President Trump has a huge say in how that this goes, and a lot can happen between now and that vote if it happens in January. The Republicans that I've talked to who are close to the president in the last few days say that McCarthy is on the edge, but he hasn't gone over the edge yet. But they leave open that possibility that the former president could eventually get there. And also say that, you know, the president is surprisingly to them not angry, but sees this as everybody was saying this sort of stuff at the time. As long as those who came around very early and got and sided with him, then he's okay with that. But one interesting thing that I found, and the president came out and said in an interview with the Wall Street Journal and said that he didn't like what McCarthy had to say, but it was said. But he was asked, will you still support him for speaker? And he said, well, you know, I don't know, is anyone else running? And it was just this shade. And when I asked somebody close to the president about that, they said, look, he always holds something in his pocket. And you don't know what else is out there. And he likes to dangle something over people who need him. And that's what he's doing here.
Peter, Carol hits at something that I think was a theme of the Trump administration when we all covered him, which is that he may say something on day one, but it may evolve.
Yes.
What he's saying right now might not be how he feels in another month or so.
Yeah, evolve is a nice word for it. Yes, absolutely. If you were Kevin McCarthy's, you know, campaign manager, you wouldn't count on anything at this point. Look, we saw Kevin McCarthy do this in real time. We saw him get up on the floor of the House during the impeachment after January 6th and said the president bears responsibility for this. He voted against impeachment, but he made very clear that he was angry at the president at the time. And then a week later, he goes to Mar-a-Lago and poses for a picture, and suddenly all is happiness and light again. So we have seen him flip-flop, in effect, on his view of former President Trump. The tape brings it home in sharp relief, right? And the thing that I was struck by as much as anything else was it says a lot about this era right now, that it was better for Kevin McCarthy to be caught out in a lie, denying something he actually said, than to be caught out saying something negative about President Trump, because he was more worried about that.
Sarah Fagan.
As soon as those receipts came out, you see, you know, Kevin McCarthy apologizing to President Trump, them trying to kind of smooth over that relationship. I mean, this week really kind of brings into sharp relief where the Republican Party is, right? From Kevin McCarthy having to apologize to then Trump at this rally in Ohio with a very fervent base still and speaking to, you know, his people who may have disagreed or said that he was wrong or bared some responsibility, but quickly kind of coming around to his point of view, because they understand that the party that he still will, you know, still wields party of power over this party.
Let's hear his sound. In fact, he was out stumping for J.D. Vance, one of the candidates in Ohio, and he made that point, I think, really so clearly. He just said it. Let's take a listen, and Sarah, get your reaction.
You know what? He's a guy that said some bad shit about me.
He did.
He did. But you know what? Every one of the others did also. In fact, if I went by that standard, I don't think I would have ever endorsed anybody in the country. You want to know? They all said bad, but they all came back.
And the he's talking about there is J.D. Vance, Sarah. But what does this say about Trump's grip on the Republican Party right now?
Well, there's no doubt that he is still the dominant figure in the party, and that is going to continue until the next presidential campaign. And he may be a candidate for that, and he may continue to be the dominant Republican, but somebody else might also emerge. I mean, it's just not in the interest of these candidates to pick a fight with Trump. It hasn't ended well for anybody in office to go at President Trump directly. And so what you see playing out here by these candidates, by Speaker McCarthy, hopeful Speaker McCarthy, is that in their political interests, there's no point in it. And so they quickly try to move on. And that's the smart political thing for them to do.
And what's interesting is this moment, he almost seems to be emboldened by it, saying, I can win them over.
Well, Trump has always been quick to anger and quick to forgiveness. You know, what Trump measures is, do you like him? And do you like him in the moment? And he seems to sort of feed on the fight, and he enjoys the fight, and he enjoys winning. And ultimately what happens here is that he gets members who are at odds with him, sometimes over very legitimate things, to kind of placate and come back around. And in some ways, you can become more esteemed in President Trump's eyes by doing that.
Looming over all of this are these culture wars. We saw this play out this week in Florida, where they essentially voted to remove the special status of Disney World for disagreeing with this law that bans discussion of gender and sexuality in schools through the third grade, what critics call the Don't Say Gay bill. Carol, how much, as we talk about the midterms, are culture wars going to factor in?
Look, there are Republicans who think that the culture wars are a winner for them, particularly on the transgender issues when it comes to parents. I spoke with a Republican strategist over the weekend who said if it's culture wars and immigration, it's over. We win. Mm. There are Republicans, though, who are concerned about the short-term benefits of that don't play out in the long term. But Democrats are struggling to come up with a response to all of this.
Aaron, why are Democrats still struggling? Because we saw this, particularly in the Virginia governor's race, for example. Culture wars were front and center. And yet, Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic candidate for governor, really struggled to find his footing on how to address it.
Yeah, and that's exactly, Republicans know that Democrats don't have a response to the culture wars, right? And so they are continuing to do this. You're seeing this, whether it's Governor Abbott out of Texas or Governor DeSantis out of Florida. They know that talking about these things that really galvanize their voters is something that has been played to effect. It is a feature, not a bug, of the Republican playbook going into November.
All right, and we do have much more to discuss coming up. The battle over mask mandates. Who gets to make the rules? That's when we come back.
In this market, you'll find Fisher Investments is different than other money managers.
Different how? Aren't we all just looking for the hottest stocks?
Nope. We use diversified strategies to position our clients' portfolios for their long-term goals.
But you still sell investments that generate high commissions for you, right?
No, we don't sell commission products. We're a fiduciary, obligated to act in our clients' best interest.
So when do you make more money? Only when your clients make more money?
Yep, we do better when our clients do better. At Fisher Investments, we're clearly different.
Can a company make the planet a better place?
At Walmart, we're pursuing 100% renewable energy in our operations and aiming to protect millions of acres of land so we can all live better.
My A1C stayed here. It needed to be here.
Ruby's A1C is down with Rybelsus.
My A1C wasn't at goal. Now I'm down with Rybelsus.
Mom's A1C is down with Rybelsus.
In a clinical study, once daily Rybelsus significantly lowered A1C better than a leading branded pill. Rybelsus isn't for people with type 1 diabetes. Don't take Rybelsus if you or your family ever had medullary thyroid cancer or have multiple endocrine neoplasia syndrome type 2 or if allergic to it. Stop Rybelsus and get medical help right away if you get a lump or swelling in your neck, severe stomach pain, or an allergic reaction. Serious side effects may include pancreatitis. Tell your provider about vision problems or changes. Taking Rybelsus with a sulfonylurea or insulin increases low blood sugar risk. Side effects like nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea may lead to dehydration, which may worsen kidney problems.
Need to get your A1C down?
Ask your healthcare provider about Rybelsus today.
Our commitment to you is clear. Save money, live better.
offer everyday low prices, fresh groceries delivered to your door, and prescriptions as low as $4, so you can live a little better each day.
Tell me you're looking out for someone.
Got several names.
William H. Bonney, Kid Andrew,
and Billy the Kid.
My family came to America on the promise of fair treatment for all.
You have been arrested for murder.
It was self-defense.
I like outlaws.
Believe me, I really do not want to kill you.
Make sure he gets a decent burial.
Let's go have some fun before they put us in the ground.
Nearly a dozen hours after the eye roared ashore. There is some late-breaking news.
All right, it just feels so.
Welcome back. We want to note the passing yesterday of former Senator Orrin Hatch. The Utah Republican was first elected in 1976 and served seven terms along with seven presidents. A child of the Depression who grew up in abject poverty, Hatch became a leading conservative voice as the country moved to the right during his long Senate career. He was a regular on Meet the Press, appearing 32 times in his career. Hatch was the longest serving Republican in Senate history and left on his own terms.
We must restore the culture of comedy, compromise, and mutual respect that used to exist here and still does in some respects. Both in our personal and public conduct, we must be the very change we want to see in the country. We must not be enemies, but friends.
Powerful words there. Orrin Hatch was 88. Welcome back. We do want to note that in France today, a struggling president, Emmanuel Macron, is up for re-election. His opponent is the far-right Marine Le Pen, who was once a fringe figure, but now has a legitimate shot at winning the presidency. Le Pen is critical of NATO, an admirer of Vladimir Putin, and could seriously complicate the West's support of Ukraine. And Peter Baker, the White House is watching this very closely, this election.
Yeah, they are. And look, you know, we don't have any exit polls yet from the election. President Macron went in with a lead of around 13 points. He's likely to win this round. But the fact that she could get 42-45% of the vote says a lot. It says a lot about where France is. It says a lot about where Europe is right now in this confrontation with Russia. There's a lot of sentiment out there that is not in keeping with the unified tone of NATO against Russia. And that's a worry for President Biden and the West generally.
And add it to the list of crises and complications that the Biden administration is dealing with right now. And Sarah Fagan and I spoke with Senator Warren about the mask issue this week, the fact that there was so much confusion over what to do in the wake of this Florida decision that the Biden administration has now appealed.
Well, I mean, we're at a point, you know, in this pandemic, you know, 2+ years in, where the public is exhausted. And confusion has been a theme throughout this entire pandemic, where we've seen the CDC and government, both administrations, put out pretty conflicting advice. And so the public gets on an airplane and says, half the plane has their mask off because they're eating or drinking, but somehow we have to keep the masks on. It just doesn't make sense. And with the era of vaccines and boosters, people need to be able to make their own decisions. And these health bureaucrats should not be making these decisions. And to allow this to continue, the public is exhausted from it.
And people may be done with COVID, but COVID is not done with us. And I think that that is something that is clear. What is not clear, though, is guidance from our government at the federal, state, local level. You've got a lot of conflicting messages, right? And this is particularly concerning for parents and for other people who are vulnerable, who really are looking for a consistent message on what they are supposed to do. And this is taking us back to an era where there was a lot of confusion and people were really kind of having to
to navigate this on their own.
You're in Philly where there was real whiplash.
Literally just, you know, for a matter of days, it felt like hours, you know, that the city of Philadelphia had gone from restoring the mask mandate, becoming like the first big city to do that, to then suddenly saying, oh, no, never mind. Cases are down. Suddenly, we're going to go ahead and take that mandate down.
Carol.
For the Biden administration, just politically and practically, they put themselves in a box by saying that they were going to follow the science and let the CDC take the lead. They constantly put things in the CDC's lap. This is another one of them. Even the Justice Department did that. They waited for the CDC to say, yes, we want you to appeal this on the grounds that we want to have this authority going forward. When you talk to White House officials, there is this sort of frustration with the fact that they did put themselves in this box and now they're stuck with trying to manage it.
They seemed flat-footed this week when the decision came in.
Yes, they were caught off guard by this decision to begin with.
But the situation in Philadelphia, I think, is really what this is about, is you have governments going in and imposing mandates or keeping mandates, and the people are upset. And this is politicians reacting to voters. This is what this is. We saw it in D.C., you know, all of a sudden masks came off schools and it happened very quickly. And even as the cases are spreading, which they have been here, they're not going back.
Peter, final to you. How does this loom and weigh in over the midterms? Because this is an issue that is not going away.
Well, it's not going away, to Aaron's point. COVID is not done with us. I think we're done with mandates. The Biden administration is just as happy to have the mandates go away because they know that politically it's just a mess, but they don't want to give up the authority legally, so they're going to appeal to do that. But it hangs over everything. If COVID is on the way back, especially if these cases are spreading, I think almost everybody in my wife's family has it right now. My son has it. It means that there is a continued damper on the public mood and spirit. They want to be past this, and that has an impact on people in power. That doesn't help in an election if the public is sour about the way things are going in the country, even though you have a lot of good things you can talk about.
Fantastic panel. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it. That is all for today. Thank you for watching. We do want to say a very big happy birthday to Chuck Todd, and Chuck will be back next week because if it's Sunday, it's Meet the Press.